Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, you might be looking for ways to stay fit and active, but if you find yourself frequently running because of a sudden urge to go to the bathroom, it might be time to talk to a urologist. And we have one for you today, Dr. Michael Guralnick, back with us once again. He's a professor of urology at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, and we'll talk with him about how often you should or shouldn't be going to the bathroom, and we'll look at strategies to stay hydrated. After all, today is National Hydration Day. So as we move along, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you're having trouble making it through work meetings without excusing yourself to go to the bathroom. Maybe you're getting up too many times in the middle of the night, concerned about what might be causing your overactive bladder. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Michael Guralnick, welcome back. Thanks for joining in again.
Thanks for having me.
Can you explain how communication between the bladder and the brain works?
How much time do we have?
Well, I'm thinking about driving along on the interstate, and I'm not thinking at all about going to the bathroom, but then I'll see a sign for a restroom, and then suddenly I'll think I have to go.
Yeah, you're not alone. That the other common triggers are even just getting out of the car or getting to your home and putting the key in the door, or just walking by a bathroom, or even, you know, putting your hand under the tap water. All notorious triggers to stimulate the bladder. Almost like a Pavlovian response.
Yeah,
and there's incredible communication between the brain and the central nervous system and the bladder, probably more complex than even the regulation of the heart, and that's where a lot of the focus of current research is in dealing with nuisance bladder issues.
Yeah, how do we know when it's time to go to the bathroom?
Well, normally your bladder fills up with urine, and there are certain nerve receptors in the bladder that start to send signals to the brain as the bladder is starting to fill up. They have these receptors that get stretched, and then that triggers the receptors to send signals to the nervous system through the spinal cord, and then it gets processed in the brain, and then the brain sends signals back to the bladder, usually telling the bladder to stay quiet. So there's these inhibitory signals, and that's why generally you don't wet yourself. In patients who have overactive bladder issues, sometimes these signals don't work properly, and so the brain isn't able to inhibit the bladder properly, and then these patients have to suddenly go urgently and maybe even not make it to the bathroom in time. I liken it to a baby's bladder. You know, a baby doesn't have that regulation. It takes the maturation process to develop that. So the baby's bladder just fills up, and it sends signals that go to the spinal cord, and then there's an actual reflex that triggers the bladder to go. And then as the baby matures, then these regulatory processes start to develop and kick in.
Interesting. Is there an ideal number of times we should be going to the bathroom every day?
Some of my patients would love to only go once a day. You know, it's kind of arbitrary. The International Continence Society, which is this big international society of urologists, gynecologists, neurologists, arbitrarily has defined urinating up to 8 times in 24 hours as being a normal urinary frequency. The problem with that is it doesn't factor in how much urine is actually being produced. If somebody is producing a tremendous amount of urine, you would expect them to have to go more frequently. And so just selecting an arbitrary number, it doesn't really work well unless you also factor in how much urine is being produced.
Is it, you know, you've heard this, the old adage, never pass up a chance to go to the bathroom, but is it possible to take too many bathroom breaks, and can that lead to problems?
Well, for some people, yeah, you know, the bladder is a creature of habit that can be trained both positively and negatively, and so if you get in a habit of you know, often going, you know, just because you're about to leave the house, or, you know, some people go right before meals, which, you know, at the time seems totally appropriate. The bladder kind of, you know, takes notice of this, and it'll actually start to, not necessarily misbehave is the right word, but it'll get so used to doing that, that when you start to do the activity that would normally lead you to go to the bathroom, whereas previously you wouldn't necessarily have the sensation of needing to go, now the bladder's actually telling you it wants to go because it's so used to doing that. And that's the concern. If you get into that habit of routinely doing things, that your bladder might take note and start to become a habit of its own. And that's what we have to actually try to break the habit of.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about my own bladder all that often. But, you know, I'm on the air. I'm in the studio for an hour before the show, and then I'm on the air for 2 hours. And typically when I'm done with the show, I may go to, you know, I'll feel, oh, okay, I've got to go to the bathroom. But if I get back to my office and then I start doing some other things right away, I realize I really didn't have to go.
Exactly. The brain can easily be distracted, and then the bladder kind of minds its own business.
Oh, man. Dan in Janesville has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Dan, hi. Sure. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hello, doctor. I have a question. Hello, Larry.
Yeah. Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
Okay. So, anyway, I have a problem I think is kind of interesting. Problem and sort of went away, I guess. For about a year, I had a burning sensation in my bladder all the time. Nothing terrible, but I could sense that it was there. Went to the doctor, had an MRI with contrast exam. Nothing unusual. Couldn't figure out what it was. A little bit of hematuria, which I've had for years. And I've been taking melatonin for years, every night, 5 milligrams. I decided to stop taking it about 2 or 3 weeks ago, you know, because I got tired of taking something every night. I'm going to learn how to go to sleep early without it. And within a week, that bladder burning sensation went away.
Hmm.
And I'm wondering if there's any irritants that may have been in that melatonin or byproduct in it, inert ingredient, that might have caused that.
You know, I can't say specifically what one, but it sure sounds like it. I've not heard of melatonin itself being an irritant to the bladder, but I suppose it's possible there was some other ingredient in the capsule that might have been an irritant. And the fact that by stopping it, your sensation went away, it's hard to ignore that. I suppose if you really wanted to test the hypothesis, you start taking that melatonin again, and if the symptom comes back and then you stop it and the symptom goes away, then you've pretty much proved that there was some ingredient in that pill or tablet.
Yeah.
I can't specify which one.
That's interesting, Dan. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You might try that experiment, or maybe you don't want to experiment.
Right.
This might be a one-shot case study here that we're talking about with Dan anyway. And by the way, you can join in too. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Can you explain the damage that straining to go to the bathroom can cause?
Well, you know, some people have to strain for various reasons. In some cases, it's because there's an actual obstruction to the flow of urine, you know, and the classic one for that is a middle-aged or elderly male with a prostate enlargement that's literally compressing or squeezing the passageway, and it's restricting the flow, and so they end up straining to supplement the bladder's ability. You know, the bladder itself has muscle that squeezes to push the urine out, but in the face of an obstruction, they'll sometimes sometimes have to strain to augment that ability. And, you know, that's actually not that uncommon, and often treatments for the prostate issue will improve that matter. But the concern when one does strain a lot is it's not so much that it's going to injure the bladder per se, but you might develop other things. So, you know, that's actually one of the common causes of a hernia. So men who have groin hernias, the classic story is they end up getting their hernia repair, and then postoperatively they can't urinate, and they have what's called urinary retention. And it's thought that the anesthesia from the surgery sort of tips them over the edge, but what it leads to is an uncovering of an underlying prostate issue that went ignored, and the hernia, the development of the hernia and then the subsequent treatment finally brought it to light. In women, you can develop a hernia in the groin, but you can also develop what's called vaginal prolapse, where various pelvic structures such as the bladder or the uterus or the rectum actually start to herniate into the vagina, and they actually develop a bulge that sometimes can protrude, and difficulties urinating with excessive straining is one of the risk factors for that as well. So, you know, the urinary tract itself can probably tolerate some degree of straining, but other structures in the body may not like it so much. And so, you know, if you can avoid straining, that's always better. Now, some people will strain to urinate simply because they really don't need to go and they're trying to force it. And again, that's part of a behavior issue where, you know, sometimes they're doing it because they want to preemptively try to empty their bladders for various reasons. And then in order to do so, because they actually don't have a feeling of needing to go, they're straining really hard to get the urine out. And again, that can lead to some of those problems that ideally you want to avoid.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Stephen in Stevens Point has something. Let's go there. Hi, Stephen.
Oh, hello. I was wondering if the doctor could allude to the advantages and disadvantages of the various methods of treating prostate cancer, such as surgery, radiation, chemotherapy.
I'd love to. I'm actually not an expert in prostate cancer. I treat more voiding dysfunctions, which are non-cancer issues. That's probably a subject that's appropriate for a different show, because that's a whole show in and of itself. And there are pros and cons to each, but I'm not sure it's really relevant as far as today's topic goes.
Steve, thank you for calling. Helen in Wabasha, we'll go to you next. Hi, Helen.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I actually have a brief comment and a question. My comment was regarding the gentleman who called in about melatonin.
Yeah.
I also have problems with melatonin. They don't display in quite the same way for me. Melatonin causes diarrhea. So I think different people react pretty differently to, you know, some people have no reactions, but I definitely do. So I just wanted to mention that. But my real question is, I have urinary incontinence and I've tried a variety of medications. And I'm wondering what this gentleman thinks about Botox injections for urinary incontinence.
Well, so the first question is what type of urinary incontinence you have. There's generally two different types, and they're treated completely differently, at least when one gets to aggressive treatments. So one type of incontinence is when you get a sudden feeling of needing to urinate, and then you can't get to the bathroom in time, and that's called urgency incontinence because it's associated with a strong urge to urinate. And that's the type of incontinence that one often will take medications and even consider something like Botox for, and that's basically what we call an overactive bladder. The other type of incontinence is incontinence that occurs with exercise or coughing or sneezing, anything that causes you to tighten up your tummy muscles. And often you don't even have a feeling of needing to urinate at the time, because in truth, that's not a bladder problem. That's a problem with the urethral sphincter, which are the brakes in the system that you would use to stop your flow when you're trying to pass your urine. And that's the type of incontinence that some women will experience after childbirth. But those are actually two different issues. So depending on which one you're experiencing, and some women, they'll actually experience both. Something like Botox is only useful for the urgency incontinence. And so if one does have that urgency incontinence, Botox is actually a very good treatment for it. It unfortunately requires a procedure to do, but it's a pretty minor procedure, just a scope. Often can be done under a local anesthetic. Doesn't last, which is another one of its downsides, because the Botox effect tends to wear off in about 6 months, but one can always repeat it. And it carries with a couple of small risks. One, you can develop a urinary infection related to the procedure. And then the biggest fear, but it's a pretty low risk, especially when you use a low dose of Botox, is that sometimes the Botox can work too well and actually weaken the bladder too much to the point that it becomes difficult to pass the urine. And some people can actually end up having to deal with a catheter temporarily to empty their bladder if the Botox kind of shut down the bladder too often. So depending on what type of incontinence you have, Botox may or may not be appropriate.
Helen, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Michael Goralnik, our guest today, it's great to have him with us, professor of urology at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Always good to have him come by as we talk with him today. You can join in as well. The number 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us today here on WPR News as we talk about the secrets to bladder health with our guest today, Dr. Michael Goralnik, great to have him back as well, professor of urology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We'll take another call. Robin in St. Paul, Minnesota, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for the show. I am curious on the role of hormone replacement therapy for menopausal, postmenopausal women in pelvic health, as well as bladder health. Has there been research studies? I'm hearing a lot about estrogen replacement, estradiol, et cetera. What you would say about that.
All right.
Sure. A great question. This is actually a hot topic nowadays. Estrogen is involved in keeping the vaginal and urogenital tissues robust and healthy. And when one goes through menopause, the body stops producing estrogen, and that can lead to tissue changes both in the vagina and in the urinary tract, what we call atrophy, where the tissues become kind of brittle, a little more irritable, and that can definitely have some adverse effects for women. And so I'm actually a huge proponent of estrogen replacement therapy, but I only use it in the context of topical application into the vagina, and not, you know, a systemic application such as using a pill or a patch, which there are some benefits to that as well. But as far as improving the urinary tract and vaginal health, I think when it's applied locally, that's when it's going to have its best effect and be the safest. And it has benefits both as far as bladder irritability and sensitivity goes. Some people who are lacking the estrogen and developing this atrophy can find their bladders more irritated. In some cases, it can even be a burning sensation in the pelvic region. In many cases, they can be more prone to urinary tract infections. And when you give back the estrogen in the form of a cream or even a vaginal suppository, it doesn't work immediately, but gradually over time, they'll often see an improvement in those kind of irritative symptoms. They can see major benefits as far as a reduction in the frequency of their urinary infections, and even an improvement in some of their nuisance bladder symptoms. And the big fear has always been that when you give the estrogen back, are you going to start to trigger, you know, malignancy in the breast or in the gynecologic organs, but most of the current research and review studies have actually come to the conclusion that vaginal estrogen replacement is actually very safe, and all these concerns about triggering cancer were probably overblown. And the recommendations is, if you're having these symptoms, you should definitely consider using it.
Yeah, Robin, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Robert in Superior next. Hi, Robert.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I just was listening to your program, and I wanted to share with you my situation. Just coming up on a year now, I've been involved in a clinical study called Proverum. It is a device that's implanted in the urethra in the prostate. It's like a spring, like a stent. And I wonder if the doctor knows about that.
Not that particular one. No, I'm going to actually have to go look at it. That it's not the first time that they've tried using urethral stents and things as an alternative to the old-fashioned prostate surgery. How's it been going for you?
It's going very well. It took a while. It was pretty traumatic when it happened, but after about 6 or 8 weeks, it really mellowed out and seemed to have worked well. I'm just in a couple of weeks going in for the 1 year checkup when they'll actually go in with a scope and look at it.
What your symptoms leading to this were, was it difficulties urinating or difficulties holding the urine or both?
No, just difficulty urinating and doing it many times in the night.
Sure. And so the insert tries to spread apart the tissues of the inside of the prostate to widen the urethra and widen the channel so that it's easier to pass the urine.
Yeah. Interesting. Robert, thanks for sharing that. Appreciate it very much. Let's go to Bob in Kakana. Your turn. Hi, Bob.
Well, hi. I have a situation right now where I have to urinate frequently, and I have somewhat of an enlarged prostate, and they tried me on different drugs. I'm currently on one called Mibetric, which is very expensive, and it seems to keep me from waking up 4 times a night to go to the bathroom. But I've had 2 friends who've had surgery. One had TURP, and the other had like an aquablation, and they're very happy with the results. And I don't know whether I should continue on a drug or encourage to go to the operation. What are your thoughts on that?
Great question. So to clarify, the medicine you're actually on is not a prostate medicine. Mirbetric, or otherwise known as mirabegron, is actually an overactive bladder drug that targets the bladder, not the prostate. And what it does is it tries to help relax the bladder, because sometimes people will urinate often because the bladder itself is misbehaving and making you need to pass your urine, even though maybe the bladder isn't all that full. And that's actually what an overactive bladder is. In men, the question is whether the bladder is overactive because of a blockage from the prostate. So the operations that you described, the TURP or transurethral resection of the prostate or the aqua ablation, are both different ways of scraping out basically some of the prostate tissue from the inside to widen the passageway and remove a blockage to the flow. And then the theory is that by getting rid of said prostate blockage, the bladder can calm down because now it doesn't have to work so hard to push the urine past the blockage. And then that leads to a reduction in how often one urinates. So the big question in your case is, is your prostate really the underlying culprit, or might you actually just have an overactive bladder that's independent of the prostate, and then the medicine that's targeting the bladder is what's working for you, in which case then you might not want to consider prostate surgery. So the question to ask your urologist, assuming that that's who's been prescribing it for you, is how much do they actually think the prostate itself is the problem here? And in some cases, we'll resort to some specialized testing of the bladder and the prostate called urodynamic testing, where you can actually potentially prove that the prostate is causing a restriction to flow. And if you prove that, then you might consider the surgery if you're hoping to get off medication.
Yeah, there you go, Bob. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's take another call. Perry in Wisconsin Rapids will go to you now. Thanks for calling, Perry. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I'm 74 years old, and I have an enlarged prostate. They said it was massive, but I'm having surgery in September. But my problem is, if I really have to pee bad, I can't go. So I'm in the habit of... And I drive truck, quad axle dump truck, so whenever I can get someplace, I'm going to the bathroom so I don't get that pressure. And I was just wondering if that's all I can do. And
yeah,
they tried to put me on some certain medications, but I had side effects and wound up in the emergency room. So I'm definitely not going on that.
Sure. Well, so it sounds like you said you're having the prostate surgery in a couple of months, and that definitely has the potential to help the symptoms that you're describing. In some cases, you know, the prostate, as I said, can restrict the flow, so you have that urge to urinate, and it's a struggle to get the urine to come out, and doing the prostate surgery can definitely help with that. And so what can you do in the meantime? Well, it's probably put up with things and do what you're currently doing until you get to said surgery.
Yeah, there you go, Perry. Thank you very much for calling. And we have some open lines. Finally, I can get you in pretty quickly at 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could shoot an email to talk@wpr.org. Had a question about oxybutynin alternatives. Is mirbetric the best one? Is there a best way to get off oxybutynin and switch to an alternative? We didn't have a name attached to this.
That's okay, but that's actually a great question. So these drugs, oxybutynin, mirbetric, there's another variety of ones called Vesicare, Gemtesa, these are all what we call overactive bladder drugs. And so they target the bladder to try to relax the hyperactive or overactive bladder muscle that's causing the bladder to have to go urgently and frequently. And oxybutynin and mirbetric are each in a different class. There's one class called anticholinergics, which is what oxybutynin is. The other class is called a beta adrenergic, and that's what mirbetric is. And they work completely different from each other. They target two different nerve receptors that trigger the bladder. Oxybutynin is probably the oldest, most well-known overactive bladder drug. As far as their ability to actually work on the bladder and relax it, they're pretty much equivalent. No study has ever confirmed one of these drugs to actually be superior to any of the other ones as far as their ability to improve the bladder. The issue has to do with their side effects. Mm-hmm. And drugs like oxybutynin, which are in the class of anticholinergic drugs, are notorious for side effects. The most common being dry mouth, second most common probably constipation, blurred vision. And with oxybutynin in particular, the biggest concern is that it can get into the brain and block the same nerve receptor in the brain that can actually lead to mental fogginess. And there's even some concerns about dementia-like effects with chronic use. So lots of people are actually trying to get off oxybutynin for that concern. And a drug like Myrbetriq is a great alternative because it doesn't generally carry those risks because it works through a different mechanism. Unfortunately, the biggest problem with all of this is the nature of the American medical system that seems to be run by insurance companies who dictate which medications they're willing to pay for. And oxybutynin is undoubtedly the cheapest of the bunch, which, and of course, it causes the most side effects, whereas drugs like Myrbetriq or its newest cousin called Gemtesa tend to be some of the most expensive because they're the newest ones and they cause the least amount of side effects. And so then it becomes a matter of trying to argue with the insurance company to get these covered. So ideally, I would love to put everybody on a drug like Myrbetriq or this new one called Gemtesa, but sometimes we don't have the luxury to be able to do so because the patient's insurance won't pay for it.
Mm. There's a related question here to in an email to oxybutynin. Janine from Fond du Lac takes oxybutynin once or twice a day for hyperhidrosis.
Sure.
She says she can last the entire day without urinating and wants to know if this is safe.
Well, I guess it depends on how much urine she's producing and how full her bladder is actually getting. Because, yes, that's one of the anticholinergic side effects of a drug like oxybutynin is that it can actually block your sweat glands. And so that's what leads to the improvement in excessive sweating. Now, you have to be careful with weather like we're having now because you need to be able to sweat for your body to cool down. And so actually one of the risks in people who take oxybutynin in weather like this is that they can actually overheat and be much more prone to heat stroke and stuff. But of course, you know, she's taking it for her sweating, but it's also going to have its effects on the bladder and even on the bowel. So it'll potentially contribute to constipation as well. So, you know, prolonged urine holding in and of itself is sometimes okay for some people and for other people, not so much. Some people are more prone to urinary infections if they try to hold their urine too long. So I think it really depends on whether she's experiencing any of issues like that. If she's not having any problems and is still urinating, then it's probably fine.
Mary in Green Bay will go to you. Hi, Mary. Mary, are you there? Well, I tell you what, I know what she wants to ask, and her advice. She wants advice on how much water to be drinking. How much water should we drink?
Great question. We normally tell people to drink so that you're not thirsty. You know, there's the old adage that you got to drink eight-ounce cups of water a day. So that's about 64 ounces. And that's great, but some people, you know, interpret that to mean they got to drink at least that, but then on top of all their other coffee, juice, milk, soda. And so then they're actually drinking, you know, closer to 100 ounces. So, you know, the average person probably consumes roughly 60 to 70 ounces of liquid a day, you know, roughly 2 liters of fluid. And that's a perfect amount unless you're sweating excessively, such as during weather like we're having, where it's probably recommended to up the fluid intake. Or if you're prone to form kidney stones, well, then you have to drink lots because you've got to keep your urine nice and dilute in order to prevent kidney stone formation. Or if you're having constipation issues, you want to make sure you're maintaining a good fluid intake, because to treat constipation, it's not just fiber. The fiber needs water with it to keep the stools bulky and soft. So there is no actual magic number as far as what's the right amount, but roughly around, you know, 60 to 70 ounces a day is very reasonable.
Virginia emailed a 70-year-old woman who, when she urinates, she thinks she's done, but when she stands up, she finds there might be some urine that drips down her leg. She wants to know if there's something she can do besides Kegel exercises, which she's been doing to help the issue.
Another very common concern for patients. Now, it really depends on whether she's actually emptying her bladder adequately or not. And that for that, you'd need to have what we call a post-void residual checked, where you can actually use either an ultrasound or a catheter to measure what's left in the bladder after one urinates. Because if it turns out there's actually a fair bit left behind, well, that's a whole separate issue versus, you know, if it's pretty well empty and it's a few extra drops, generally the Kegels would be the way to go. What I'll sometimes have patients do if we haven't found anything of concern and it's just a nuisance few drops that happens after they finish urinating is they do what we call double voiding, where, you know, they wipe themselves. And then before they stand up to pull up their clothes, they stand up a little bit, but then sit back down and see if they can get that last little bit out and then get up to pull up their clothes. If it's a true problem with emptying of the bladder, then sometimes we might use some medication to see if that facilitates things. The problem then becomes, especially in women, is that, you know, sometimes if you make it too easy to empty, then sometimes they can start having troubles holding in the urine because you've made it too easy for the urine to come out, and you have to try to find the right balance.
David from Shorewood emailed. He's 64 with BPH and a distended bladder with no ability to produce pressure per my urodynamic test. Two different urologists have made recommendations that are differing. One's promoting surgery, the other is not, just recommending monitoring. Wants to know the risks post-surgery if prostate is opened up.
So I'm presuming that they're referring to either the transurethral resection of the prostate, or what some people might argue is the better surgery in this context is something called the HoLEP, a holmium laser enucleation of the prostate. And again, the theory here is that if you can reduce any resistance to the outflow for the urine to flow, that might improve the bladder's ability to empty, especially when it doesn't seem that the bladder's muscle itself is able to push the urine out, which is what it's sounding like in his case if they said that the bladder can't build enough pressure. And historically, we used to think, well, if the bladder itself doesn't work and this muscle is kind of just this floppy bag and you're unable to build up pressure in the bladder and get the urine to come out, that even if you did prostate surgery, the odds are it's not going to help and you're still not going to be able to adequately empty. But in fact, there's actually a fair bit of evidence to suggest that at least with the HoLEP, that holmium laser surgery, patients whose bladders don't seem to work even on the urodynamics test can achieve benefits from doing the surgery to scrape out or use the laser to remove the bulky prostate tissue that's thought to be creating that resistance. Now, the risks are the risks of surgery. There's going to be a risk for bleeding that could sometimes require a secondary procedure or possibly a blood transfusion, a risk for infection, a urinary infection, a risk for scar tissue formation in the urethra or the passageway that itself could create a blockage, and even a risk for incontinence where you have trouble holding in the urine. But the good news is that for the majority of patients who do experience that incontinence after a surgery like that, it's transient and gradually seems to improve. And so you always have to weigh the benefits, the potential benefits against the risks. Now, there's no guarantee that the surgery is going to resolve everything, but it's definitely not unreasonable to consider it.
Our guest today, Dr. Michael Goralnik, professor of urology at the Medical College of Wisconsin. It's great to have him with us today, located in Milwaukee, of course, as we talk bladder health with him. And you can join in. The number to call, we have open lines, get you on pretty quickly now, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, and the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Just a quick mention, at noon today, we'll talk about summer movies with a local film reviewer. And also coming up Thursday is our one-day member drive. And you don't have to wait till Thursday. You can donate right now. And it would help us out because there's a little incentive once we have, I forget the number now, a certain number of people phone in with a contribution. We have a bunch of donors who have gotten together, and we have $12,000 that'll be added right to the start if we have enough contributions or enough people contributing beforehand. So you can go to WPR.org/donate and make that contribution right now as you listen to our guest, Dr. Michael Goralnik, talking about achieving and maintaining a healthy bladder. And for that, you can call us at 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Tom emailed, can catheters help with BPH or overactive bladders?
So catheters are purely meant to help empty the bladder. It's basically bypassing the natural act of urination, and you use a catheter to insert into the urethra to get into the bladder to drain the bladder. So it doesn't actually treat BPH per se. It can deal with any urinary retention or inability to empty the bladder, but it's not actually treating the prostate per se. It's essentially trying to bypass the natural urination mechanism. As far as an overactive bladder goes, the catheter, again, doesn't treat anything as far as helping the bladder to hold the urine better. It's purely to help empty the bladder. Now, in some patients who might have an overactive bladder, some of the treatments that we might use, even sometimes medication, but specifically the using Botox, that can sometimes weaken the bladder to the point that it has trouble emptying. And then one might resort to catheterization to empty, and that allows you to continue with the treatment that's trying to improve the bladder's ability to hold in the urine, and then you're just using the catheter to get the urine out.
John wants to know, how often, if at all, is it normal to get up in the night to go to the bathroom?
Another great question. And again, the International Continence Society defines abnormal nighttime urination as waking up twice or more to go to the bathroom. So in truth, waking up once at night is actually normal. And actually, as one gets older, you might even argue even up to twice at night would not be unheard of or uncommon in somebody who's in their 70s, 80s, or 90s. Again, to some degree and to a major degree, it has a lot to do with how much urine is being produced. And there are some people who have a tendency to make an excessive amount of urine at night, even though it's not intentional. They're not necessarily drinking all night long. Their metabolism, in some cases, it can even be related to the lack of a certain hormone, or even entities such as sleep apnea, which is a notorious cause of excessive nighttime urination, or leg swelling that tends to worsen over the course of the day, and then you lie down at night and all that swelling goes away because all that fluid in the legs has now gotten back into the vascular system, and they start producing lots of urine at night, and that will contribute to having to wake up too many times to go. But that's because the bladder is potentially actually getting full at night and it has to go. That itself is not necessarily a bladder problem or even a prostate problem. It's a problem related to too much urine production, which you have to treat differently. Now, in some cases, there is an actual bladder dysfunction or a prostate issue such as benign prostate hyperplasia or BPH that's causing the nighttime urination, but those patients don't produce excessive amounts of urine. So technically, more than once a night is what's considered abnormal, but that can be for a variety of reasons.
Yeah. And I know I have some friends who hold back on water or fluids later in the day.
Sure.
Is that a reasonable thing for elderly, older people?
Yeah. we'll often recommend, you know, try not to drink very much after dinner, or, you know, really try to limit it. But unfortunately, as I said, in some cases, the body is retaining fluids throughout the day, and it's only once you go to bed at night that it actually starts coming out, especially in people with leg swelling. That's a notorious one. And so what we'll tell them to do is ideally you wear compressive stockings to try to minimize how much fluid accumulates in the legs. I'll even have patients try to take a late afternoon lie down and maybe put their legs under some pillows on the couch and watch the news or read something at around 4 or 5 o'clock with the hope of getting that fluid out of their legs earlier in the evening, being prepared that you're going to have to urinate when that happens. But the hope is that if you can get rid of that excess fluid earlier in the evening, then there's less of it to cause problems once you actually do go to bed at night. So it's a dilemma, and in many cases they're taking, you know, diuretics or water pills to help them get rid of the fluid, and inevitably they take it first thing in the morning because that's when it's the easiest time to take your medications and the time that you're going to be most likely to remember it. But of course, if they're taking that medicine to help get rid of that swelling, well, first thing in the morning is often when the leg swelling's at its best because they've spent the whole night supine and you don't have the effect of gravity pushing all the fluid into their legs. So it actually makes the least amount of sense to take your water pill first thing in the morning when your legs are at their best. So again, I'll tell them, take the water pill when you're about to have that late afternoon lie down to really encourage that fluid to get out of your system. But again, be prepared that, you know, following that lie down, which maybe you do it for a half an hour or an hour, you're probably going to have to go fairly often and potentially even in a bit of a hurry, but that might be a fair price to pay to allow you to sleep better at night.
Is there a connection, or maybe you could explain the connection, if there is one, between a healthy diet and a healthy bladder?
Well, our, you know, the diet's important for everything. And as far as the bladder goes, there are some classic dietary irritants that for, and it doesn't affect everybody the same way, but for some people, it's pretty typical. And the classic irritants for the bladder are things like alcohol, caffeine, spicy foods, acidy foods like citrus or tomatoes, and we don't necessarily know the exact mechanisms, but they seem to be more irritating for the bladder. And when people consume them, they can sometimes find that their bladder's more uncomfortable. In some cases, it can actually be outright painful. In other cases, they just feel that constant urge to urinate and maybe even have strong urgency. And so the general recommendation is to, you know, avoid such irritants. But what I tell patients to do is you have to figure it out for yourself, because again, not everybody responds the same way. So you choose whatever possible irritant that you might be consuming a fair bit of, and you get a baseline assessment of how their bladder's behaving while on it, and then you stop it for a week or two and then see how does your bladder behave when you've not been taking it. And if you can tell a big difference, well, then you've proved that maybe that's one that you should consider avoiding, unless the joy and pleasure that you get from consuming it outweighs any misery that your bladder might cause you. Just like I liken it to the smoker who doesn't like their cough but keeps on smoking. Well, you know, if you want to keep smoking, go for it, but then you can't complain, why am I coughing?
In the last minute, Carol emailed, are there any advancement in the treatment of interstitial cystitis at the recommendation of her urologist? She has had good success with a product named Preleaf.
So Preleaf is actually a supplement, so it's not a prescription medication, that helps to neutralize some of the acid in foods in the diet. And as I said, certain people, an interstitial cystitis, which is this basically a painful bladder condition that we don't really know what's the cause of it, and unfortunately there hasn't been a very good treatment for it. But if a patient knows that when they eat acidy foods, that really irritates their bladder, then something like Preleaf might allow them to cheat and continue eating said platter irritant of acidy food without getting the misery caused by it. So that's where Preleaf comes into play if acidy food is a big irritant for you. But it's not going to help the other types of irritants, you know, like caffeine or alcohol. So unfortunately, we don't have great options. In some cases, we will actually use painkillers or an antidepressant to help the discomfort from interstitial cystitis. We might even use treatments that go right into the bladder.
On that note, Dr. Guralnick, thank you so much for being with us. I hope we can do this again. Thank you very
much. Absolutely. My pleasure. Anytime.
Dr. Michael Guralnick, professor of urology at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. And coming up, a look at the latest summer movies. I'm Larry Mueller.
Coming up.
Oh, the music from Jurassic Park, if I am not mistaken. Lee Rayburn put that up for us, which is a good way to introduce us to our next segment, which deals with movies. Have you seen any good movies lately? I know our next guest has. Jameson Rabbit has seen over 5,900 movies, and if he's anything like me, that equals a lot of popcorn. Jason, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today, talking about summertime movies with Jameson Rabbit. Jameson's been hosting a movie review program. It's titled Real Reviews, as in R-E-E-L, Reviews, for the past decade. He's also on the staff of the Wisconsin Film Festival. And as we move along today, I hope you'll join in. What are your favorite summertime movies? What are you excited about seeing this year? And maybe what do you look for in a good summer flick? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Jameson Rabbit, welcome to the show.
Hey, Larry, it's a pleasure to be here with you. What an intro.
I tell you, you know, I did some research before the show. I was wondering, are Wisconsin theater goers any different from the national average? And I found three things.
Okay.
One was affordability. Wisconsin has one of the cheapest average movie ticket prices in the U.S., ranking as the third cheapest for a single ticket and the fourth cheapest for a date night, according to a source. This is significantly lower than the national average.
That really surprises me, actually. I mean, because one
people
of the,
complain about.
Oh, yeah. One of the complaints I always hear is, well, movie tickets are so expensive, you know, blah, blah. But that actually surprises me that we are that low compared to the rest of the country.
Cheap compared to everybody else. And then passion for the screen. There was a 2020 study that indicated that Wisconsin residents missed movie theaters more than any other state during the COVID-19 pandemic. Suggesting, of course, a strong appreciation for the theater experience.
They must have called me during that survey. I concur with that 100%.
And then finally, and then we'll move on here, support for local film culture. Events like Milwaukee Film Festival have shown really strong attendance, and that demonstrates local engagement for diverse cinematic offerings.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. Between, you know, Milwaukee Film Festival, Wisconsin Film Festival, even the smaller ones, we have a very robust film community in this area and an appreciation for film in this area, which is great. A lot of people probably wouldn't expect that out of Wisconsin. You know?
Yeah, but here we are. We're good moviegoers.
That's right.
I guess. Well, we've gotten used to summer being when a lot of the biggest blockbuster movies come out. When did summer become the time for movie blockbusters?
I mean, we are kind of celebrating the 50th anniversary of the first summer blockbuster. Set 1975, Jaws came out, and that was really the hallmark of that's when a summer blockbuster was created. Whether on purpose or not, I mean, there's a whole lore around the surprise hit of Jaws. But since that time, you can kind of mark time. Like in my head, I kind of mark years by what the summer blockbuster was that year. And every year there's that one or two that are just standout big budget tentpole movies.
Yeah, it was Lee Rayburn and I were watching Robert Shaw, his classic conversation, or not conversation, his classic comments on the Indianapolis.
Yes,
in the movie,
his story
Jaws.
About surviving the USS Indianapolis. One of the great scenes in all of movies.
Oh man, well, what are so Jaws was the first.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of recognized that that was the first time a movie came out, you know, specifically in the summer, and people were lined up around the blocks for basically the entire summer. It was a successful novel, and people flocked out to the movies. And then 1977, Star Wars, and it just kind of became a thing then. And now, you know, movie theater companies build their schedule, build their calendar around when's the summer opening, what's going to be the big movie that opens the summer. And, you know, various weekends have been the tent poles for that.
Have there been some, I'm sure there have been some duds.
Oh, absolutely.
The big, you know, you're expecting a big thing.
I mean, notoriously, Will Smith for a while, starting with Independence Day, I believe in 96, Independence Day was a huge July 4th movie. And then the next year, Men in Black was another huge July 4th movie for Will Smith. And he became known as the guy who just dominated the 4th of July. And then Wild Wild West, the remake of the television series, came out July 4th and was a massive bomb and lost hundreds of millions of dollars. And was, I mean, and the studio, you know, they, part of it is the big budget for summer movies. Part of it is the money that they put into advertising and merchandise tying into it. And when that fails the opening weekend, all that money's tied up and you're never getting it back.
Why did that fail?
It just wasn't a good movie. Really. It's a pretty rough watch.
Well, and nowadays we've got streaming services, you know, and so I'm wondering, do they target for summer too?
They do. There's a couple of movies specifically like this summer that are targeted for the summer blockbuster, as it were, audience to kind of get people talking. I mean, later this summer you have kind of a legacy sequel, Happy Gilmore 2, Adam Sandler's decades-old sequel to a modest kind of cult hit from the 90s. And now that's a Netflix streaming movie because Adam Sandler almost exclusively makes Netflix movies now. And that's scheduled for later this summer, and it's getting a lot of buzz.
I watched The Accountant.
Sure.
And then I saw The Accountant 2 just came out.
Yes.
And watched it. It was kind of a, I guess you'd call that a summer movie, huh?
Yeah, it's kind of on the edge there.
And kind of enjoyed Ben Affleck in that.
I really enjoyed the first one a lot.
Yeah, the first one was much better, I think.
I think so, too, yeah. I agree.
Than the second one. Well, theater, let's talk about some of the trends. What do we got coming out this summer?
There's a lot, actually. I mean, it's a big summer. We've already kind of started Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
Final Reckoning was kind of the start of your blockbuster season, I think. I mean, that's a massive, massive $300, $400 million movie.
And I haven't seen it yet. I've seen every one of the Mission Impossible ones. I just haven't gotten to the theater yet to see it.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of, I think that was the marker for, okay, we started big blockbuster summer season. There's been a few come out this year, but coming up, I mean, you played the music to Jurassic Park. Next week, Jurassic World Rebirth, the new Jurassic movie, and that's another one. I mean, Steven Spielberg is kind of like synonymous with summer blockbusters. He created the summer blockbuster, and Jaws and Raiders Lost Ark and E.T. and Jurassic Park. Like, these are all Spielberg movies that he put out right in the middle of summer to maximize profits. And he's not making this one, but the Jurassic franchise continues to be big business in the summer.
It's still doing well. They're still making money.
They keep making them, whether they're good or not. I would say I haven't enjoyed the last couple, but I'll go see this one opening night because it's a big, summer movie. Why not? It's fun. It's dinosaurs. I'll get my popcorn. And that's kind of all you're asking for, right? Get in out of this heat, sitting in the AC.
Oh, man. So sequels. That's, you know, Jurassic Park is a sequel. You feel like there's an over-reliance on sequels and remakes, or is there some originality out there?
I think that for a number of years, studios have been really leaning on the sequels. It's easy. If it proved that it made money, let's make it again, whether it's a sequel or a remake. Just keep making that until it stops making money is kind of the idea. It does crush creativity a lot. This summer, we have a lot of sequels. There's a lot of sequels coming out and remakes. I mean, Mission Impossible was a sequel. Lilo and Stitch, which is made huge. It's the number two movie on the year already. That's a remake of Disney's animated movie. 28 years later is a sequel. All of these films, I love to celebrate original ideas. And it's kind of harder, especially in the summer. It feels like a lot of the original ideas are pushed to the fall, kind of the Oscar bait season, things like that. Yeah. Summer is for superheroes and sequels and explosions.
And I liked all those superhero movies, or most of them.
We got a few coming out this summer, too.
Yeah, a few of them coming out this summer. I've lost a little of their edge for me.
You're not the only one. And it's shown at the box office that, like, Marvel, with the Avengers leading up in making, billions of dollars, and then since then have kind of struggled to keep their footing, and it's shown with the audiences have kind of, much like you probably, have kind of lost their way with it and said, this isn't what I'm looking for anymore. But we have Superman coming out in a couple of weeks. That's kind of, there's a lot of stakes on that because there hasn't been they're rebooting Superman once again with a new Superman.
But it's been a long time, hasn't it?
There was Man of Steel a few years ago. Henry Cavill was in it when Ben Affleck was Batman. And so they're trying again with the new Superman and kind of putting a lot of eggs in this basket. If Superman doesn't work, it could really hamstring those movies.
So are there some original films coming out that you think people should see this summer?
Yes, absolutely. This week, on the 27th, there's F1, the Formula One movie, from director Joseph Kosinski, who made Top Gun Maverick, stars Brad Pitt. It should be a huge success. It looks great. Whether you like Formula One racing or not, it looks like a lot of fun. There's a movie later in the summer, in the 18th of July, it comes out, called Eddington, from director Ari Aster, who is more known for making kind of horror movies with Hereditary and Midsommar. This is a kind of a small town sheriff and a mayor get into a battle in this small town that brings everyone in. Stars Joaquin Phoenix and Pedro Pascal and Emma Stone, and it looks really interesting, and it's not like anything I've seen before.
That sounds good. And some good actors there.
Yeah, great actors, great cast.
What about the F1? I have a daughter who's 21 years old, mm-hmm. and like in the last year or two, she started really getting into the F1 races.
Sure.
And then I read a piece or two about how it's people her age and maybe slightly older have really tied into that.
I think a big part of it is Netflix started a series a couple of years ago where you started following the racers and you get to know the racers and kind of the drama, and it kind of holds your hand as an introductory course into F1. And I know a lot of people that got into that and are instantly hooked that had nothing to do with Formula One 3 years ago. And suddenly, I think a lot of them came in. That was their entry point into it.
Interesting. I tell you what, Jameson Rabbit is our guest today as we talk with him about summer movies. Do you have a favorite? Maybe you've got a favorite movie of all time. Maybe I have a question about the movies that are coming out. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today here on WPR News as we talk about the summertime movies. You know, Jill Nadeau sent me a note, and we were talking about prices, and she says that you can, for a first-run movie in Watertown, it's $3.50 for a ticket.
Amazing. You can't pass that up. What else are you going to do for that?
For $3.50?
That's incredible.
So there are places where you can go and see a movie for pretty
catch
cheap.
A movie. Wow.
Beth in Milton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Beth.
First-time caller, long-time Stephen King fan, and just went last night to see The Life of Chuck. I would say that's right up there in my mind with Shawshank Redemption and Stand By Me. It was such a good movie.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Tom Hiddleston's new movie.
What's it about? Beth, what did you like about it? What's it about? What did you like about it?
No spoilers, but it just takes you through three phases of Chuck's life, and it's all in flashbacks, and it was a feel-good movie. It was a little ghosty stuff, but overall, it was just super, super well done, and just absolutely loved it.
Oh. Beth, yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Have you seen
that? I just saw that. And it is, for Stephen King, you think, oh, scary movie, blah, blah. Yeah. But very much like Shawshank Redemption, it's a smaller story as opposed to a big ghost movie. There's no killer clowns or anything in it. It's a really interesting personal story.
And so that would
It's hard to talk about without giving spoilers, though.
Yeah, I suppose. And it's... But it's kind of an original. It's not a sequel to anything.
No, very original, yes.
Yeah, so...
Good choice.
The Life of Chuck. Beth, thank you very much. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. You've got one you want to throw in. I want to go back to the Mission Impossible series. Mm-hmm. What did you think overall of the Mission Impossible series?
I felt like they got... better as it went along. I mean, that's a franchise that's been going for almost 30 years. Started in 1996. And I was kind of in and out. I'd watched all of them in the theaters as they came out, but I was never fully hooked into them until maybe the fourth one. And then slowly started to really get excited for the next one and building up to this possible last one.
Yeah, they're at $500 million. Yeah.
Tom Cruise will always make a sequel to a movie. I mean, he's making a sequel to Maverick, which was a legacy sequel to Top Gun. He also announced that he's talking about making a sequel to Days of Thunder, his race car movie. He's never tired of making a sequel to one of his movies.
Yeah, and did you enjoy this last one?
I did. I didn't enjoy it as much as I did the last one, Dead Reckoning.
Yeah, that
from
was
a couple
really
years ago.
Good.
It's still a good time at the theater, though. I mean, it's almost 3 hours long, and it didn't feel like it.
Well, Tom Cruise has. I don't know how he manages to stay looking so young.
Yeah, there's a lot of internet theories about how that happens.
Oh man. Well, yeah. You think he's over with Mission Impossible?
I kind of don't. I kind of see him doing like Harrison Ford does with Indiana Jones, and when he's 80, saying, "I could do another one. I could probably do one more." You know, I don't think he'll ever truly be satisfied with.
Well, it's like the final reckoning. Yeah. So now, are we going to get? The final reckoning.
Larry, I think it was 1995. I went to see Ozzy Osbourne, and the name of the tour was called the No More Tours Tour. I believe that was the name of it, and it was his goodbye tour. And I believe he's still touring right now, 30 years later. I never believe anyone when they say I'm done. No.
Well,
there's always a check being written that'll bring you back.
So. What's another movie? Oh, Karate Kid. Sure. Now, I heard that one, that movie.
Karate Kid Legends, yeah.
Legends is been a bit of a disappointment. Why?
Yeah, it kind of melds. So there was the original Karate Kid with Ralph Macchio as Daniel, and then the Cobra Kai series that's been on Netflix, really successful. And then, 12 years ago, there was a Karate Kid movie starring Jackie Chan as like the Mr. Miyagi type, and this melds the two universes, Jackie Chan and Ralph Macchio, into this new story, and it's basically the exact same story as the original Karate Kid. It is. I went with my wife and my daughter. They were very excited because they love the Cobra Kai series, and they enjoyed it. I was horribly disappointed in the movie. It was not a big recommend for me.
Rebecca from Woodville emailed to echo previous comments. She just saw Chuck, Life of Chuck, with her son on Saturday. Think Stephen King, best work ever. Very poignant, meaningful, and thought-provoking. So
there you go. Two recommendations from your listeners.
What about, here's one that's, Liam Neeson.
Yes.
Is taking over for Leslie Nielsen.
Correct.
In the new Naked Gun movie.
Yes. Another legacy sequel to a movie that came out, a franchise that ended, decades ago.
Yeah.
Shouldn't work, right? When they announced it a couple years ago, they said, we're making another Naked Gun and we have Liam Neeson in it, who's spent the last probably 15 years of his career playing super serious, I'm going to go kill someone who kidnapped my family member. And I felt like that shouldn't work. But I saw the trailer for it recently, and it looks really good.
It does. Okay.
Because he's playing very straight, and everything else around him is crazy. And it's written and directed by the guy who, from the Lonely Island Boys, if anyone knows him from Saturday Night Live, good comedy troupe, directed it. And it looks like a lot of fun. I didn't think it would be, but I'm hopeful.
Yeah, it's hard for me to imagine him in that role because he's just one of these very good at killing people. And
he was Oscar Schindler. And I mean, if you would have told me 30 years ago watching Schindler's List, like that guy's going to be playing Frank Drebin's son in Naked Gun. Like, what? But it works, and it's a sequel. He plays Leslie Nielsen's character's son in this one, and it looks interesting. There's a few of those legacy sequels. This, I believe, the same weekend as that. You also have Freakier Friday, Jamie Lee Curtis and Lindsay Lohan, the body-swapping Freaky Friday, which came out 15 years ago. They have another one coming out again. It's just like picking up franchises that have been dormant for years.
I want to go back to superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic Four.
Yes.
I think is the movie coming
first
out.
First Steps, yes.
From Marvel. Is there anything new in this? Or what's...
So, yeah, this is kind of a big moment for the Marvel Universe. They've kind of been setting things up. Thunderbolts came out a couple months ago and was really good, really interesting. Kind of was resetting where Marvel wants to go with their universe now. And Fantastic Four was, they've made a few Fantastic Four movies, none of them have been successful, and they're trying one more time with this, and they've got a great cast. Pedro Pascal in this one, Vanessa Kirby, Joseph Quinn, Evan Moss Bachrock from The Bear, everyone loves him playing cousin in The Bear, and Robert Downey Jr. is in this one, I believe. I'm thinking of a different one. But this is Fantastic Four is kind of going to launch where they're going in the future. And there's a lot riding on this one. Much like I say with Superman, if Fantastic Four doesn't do well, it could kind of hamstring them. I'm kind of dubious on how this is going to work because it hasn't proven successful in the first three iterations of this story. But we'll see.
And after 20 years, we're getting another I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Right, another one, yeah.
Movie. And I've heard this one referred to as a requel. What is a requel?
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think that term, the first time I heard it was with, funnily enough, the Scream franchise when they came back after a decade off a few years ago, where it's a reboot and a sequel at the same time. So they bring back some of the cast members. Jennifer Love Hewitt, who is in the original franchise, is coming back in this one, but they're also kind of restarting the franchise. It's kind of a mishmash to me when you're not quite sure. It worked for the Scream franchise. I think they've made 3 new ones since they requeled the series. I don't know. We'll see. I've watched all of the I Know What You Did Last Summer movies recently, and they weren't great back then. I don't know how good this. We'll see. There's a new generation though that needs their own horror movies.
The War of the Roses remake is coming out. What do you know anything about that?
I don't know a whole lot about that one. War of the Roses was a great movie though.
And the whole business about remakes, is it just because, I mean, we go because we're familiar with them?
I think that's a lot of it, is you've seen something you liked before. I mean, there's one later this summer that I'm really excited for. It's a remake. I normally am kind of doggish about remakes. Like, come on, we can think for ourselves and come up with something new. I've seen this before, but later this summer, there's a movie, Spike Lee's new movie, Highest and Lowest, which is a remake of Akira Kurosawa's phenomenal movie, The High and Low. And it's Spike Lee remaking that with Denzel Washington and Jeffrey Wright. And I'm very excited for that. And that's coming out the middle of August, kind of the end of summer movie season. And you're remaking a movie that's been 60 years since it came out. A lot of people haven't seen High and the Low. First off, it was a Japanese movie by Kurosawa. It's an older movie. So those, I'm like, let's remake it. Maybe that'll bring a younger audience to go, this is a remake. I should go check out the original. Maybe.
And what, I don't even remember the plot for that.
Yeah, I struggle to remember everything about it to explain it properly. It's been 20 years since I saw High and Low.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah. It's great. I mean.
Well, I bet it hasn't been 20 years since you've seen a John Wick movie.
I just saw Ballerina a couple weeks ago, the new John Wick spin-off movie, which John Wick appears in.
Is it similar?
It happens concurrently with the last John Wick movie. It stars Ana de Armas as Ballerina, who's working for Angelica Houston, the director. She trains her to be a ballerina and a killer. She's going out to avenge somebody's death, and John Wick appears and does his John Wick things. I mean, it's the same thing you've seen before. Lots of great fight choreography, new things. It's the first time I can remember ever seeing a flamethrower shootout before. I mean, it's interesting. It's shot. It looks great. I mean, it's very much a John Wick movie with John Wick in a glorified cameo role.
His movies, are so, he kills so many people.
Yes.
But it to me, the choreography of it.
It's beautiful.
Is amazing.
Yeah. Now, I was reading the other day, they were talking about John Wick 5, and he said, I'll make it as long as it's a good story, and we have to take my age into account now. John Wick isn't a superhero. He's a man. And he says, John Wick's an aging man, just like I am, Keanu Reeves. And he says, so if we're going to keep making these, you really have to take into account the fact that I'm much older than I was for the first one. And I've taken a lot of damage in these movies. And John Wick has to move a little differently. You know, he's not a superhero.
How much would he make? His movies always, I think they always do.
They do, especially the John Wick movies, yeah.
Yeah, the John Wick movies.
Yeah, I'm not sure what his number is these days. I mean, he's kind of a private guy, which is really cool. I really like Keanu. He's got a high approval rating with a lot of people.
He's a pretty good actor.
He knows what he's good at, and he limits. There was a while there in his younger career where he was really, he was trying things, and it showed the limitations of his range. And he made some rough decisions. And I think now he's kind of honed in and said, I'm not a thespian, but I know what I'm good at. And I know what people like out of me. And yeah, that's good. Not, you don't have to be great at everything.
Yeah. And that's why it was interesting with Liam Neeson too, because, you know, he was, until he made, what was the first one that?
Taken. Yeah.
That was really a really good movie.
Yes.
And sort of, got his career going.
It did. And then he kind of just kept making that same movie over and over. His daughter would get kidnapped and it would just be a different title. They made three Taken movies and then many movies, A Walk Amongst the Tombstones, all these movies where a wife would get killed or and he'd have to avenge him. He had a certain set of skills. But before that, he was like a thespian. I remember seeing him, you know, long before that, he was a great, you know, up-and-coming, you know, actor. And now he's doing slapstick Naked Gun movies.
Well, it's interesting, and I've actually enjoyed his movies quite a bit. There's a new Wes Anderson movie, The Phoenician Scheme. Did you mention?
That just came out 2 weeks ago. Yeah, new Wes Anderson movie. I really enjoyed it. I am a big fan of Wes Anderson movies. And I understand, especially having discussions with many people, that his style is very take it or leave it. Some people really don't like his style of filmmaking. I do. And I really enjoyed The Phoenician Scheme. We reviewed it on my program this past week. My co-host did not enjoy it. He's not a Wes Anderson guy. And he did not enjoy the movie. But I gave it a big recommend.
Is this a targeted to an older audience?
Yeah, I think most of his movies kind of are. But he has a troupe of actors that follow him from movie to movie to movie. You know, Bryan Cranston, Tom Hanks, Scarlett Johansson, all these people. Bill Murray, they just kind of go from movie to movie with him. And this is, probably an older audience. I don't think he's trying to reach out to the teenagers that, have expendable income during the summer.
What's the plot line on that one?
Oh, my gosh. It's insane. So Benicio del Toro is this rich, ruthless businessman who's survived, his seventh assassination attempt and decides, okay, I need to pull off my one last scheme. I need to reunite with my long estranged daughter. He pulls his daughter out of the convent he stuck her in. And he says, you and I, we're going to go and defraud a bunch of businesses and countries to get my one last scheme over. And so them and this guy Bjorn, played by Michael Cera, travel around. And it's basically little vignettes where they go to this business and they meet Bryan Cranston and Tom Hanks, and then they go to this country and they meet this dictator, and they're pulling little schemes on all of them to kind of tie together this one last master plan of his. And it's insanity and it's crazy characters and crazy situations, and I absolutely loved it because it's not like anything you've seen before, which is great.
And not a whole bunch of people getting killed.
No, not really. And when it is, it's kind of cartoony. I mean, it's all of it is kind of very tongue-in-cheek, really dark comedy. Yeah, it's a big recommend if you like Wes Anderson films.
All right. Well, that I'm trying to think of other films that we haven't covered yet for that are coming out this summer.
Yeah, we also, let's see, what else this summer? You have Megan 2. Have you seen the killer robot movie Megan? Oh, no. Larry, you're missing out. A couple years ago, there was a movie called Megan about a killer robot small girl. It made a lot of money. So we got a sequel coming where she's coming after you again. Megan's coming for you. One that I'm really excited for later this summer is a movie called Weapons. Comes out August 8th. It's from director Zach Cregger, who made a movie a couple years ago, 3 years ago, I think, called Barbarians, which was the biggest surprise, like, great movie that I've seen in a long time. One of the movies that I went in not having seen anything, saw the movie, started watching it, thought I knew where the movie was going. It veered completely off from where I thought I was going and left me stunned walking out of there. His new movie, Weapons, is coming out. I know nothing about it. I'm trying not to watch any trailers because I kind of want to try and replicate that experience. And he has a lot of leeway with me on this movie because the first one was so stunning. So Weapons is one that I've circled on my calendar.
What's your favorite movie of all time? Summer movie?
It's tough. It might be Jaws. I mean, Jaws is one of my more rewatched movies ever. Jaws and Empire Strikes Back are probably the movies I've rewatched the most just because of my age. And it might be Raiders of the Lost Ark might be my favorite summer movie ever. I mean, I love these just big adventure movies.
Dan from Sun Prairie emailed. He says his local theater is running bingo.
Yes. Wednesday nights,
Is this a sign of desperation from movie theaters, or what?
I think it's just a way, you know, it's on Wednesday nights. I go to the bingo every once in a while out there in the, at the Palace. Wednesday nights are kind of a dead night because the new movies come out Thursday nights and Friday. Tuesday night is cheap night for, I think, $6. So Wednesday's kind of a no man's land for moviegoers, at least there. And so it's just a way to get people in and, hey, maybe you'll grab tickets to go see the new movie that comes out tomorrow. And you might win some prizes. I never do. I go and just sit there and never win a prize, but hang out and get to know some people.
So what do they give for prizes?
Every week it's different. There's big prizes that you can win, like if you get bingo within a certain amount of numbers. Then there's consolation prizes that you get if you get bingo first. I don't know. Like I said, I'm a perennial loser.
Have you ever watched a movie and said, well, that wasn't a very good movie, but I kind of liked it?
Oh,
and what? Maybe an example.
Boy, I have a lot of guilty pleasure movies. Absolutely, there's a lot of movies that when I review them, I have to acknowledge, like, look, this is a bad movie, but for some reason, I'm into it. Oh, trying to think of a good example is tough off the top of my head right now. But I'm a sucker for, you know, lowbrow movies. Usually it's comedies too, where I'm like, this is a dumb comedy. This is really dumb. But it tickled my funny bone when I needed it most. Yeah.
How'd you get started in reviewing movies, by the way?
I mean, I've just, for 30 years, I've enjoyed just discussing movies. Got, you know, in some film classes in high school, really enjoyed sitting there talking movies. And then I started a podcast 14 years ago, started a podcast talking about movies that spun off into other podcasts and spun off into the television program I do. And just kind of, it's something that I love. I love discussing movies more than critiquing movies. I hate being the film critic because I feel it's got a negative connotation. I really like just discussing movies with people and kind of giving my thoughts.
Have you ever given a review and then realized you were wrong about it?
Absolutely. I have given reviews and then rewatched the movie maybe a couple years down the road and said, wow, I must have been in a mood when I saw that movie the first time. That's actually a good movie. There's been those before. Yeah, where I look back and go, wow, I was really off. Or I'll watch a movie and usually it's that I didn't like it, and then I'll talk about it with somebody else and they'll start telling me what they liked about it, and I'll see it in a different light and realize, like, okay, maybe I went into it not wanting to like it, or maybe it stars somebody I don't like. I can admit when I'm wrong, but I will argue with you a lot of times and tell you that I'm not.
Jameson Rabbit, our guest today, film reviewer, talking about summer films. Call in with your questions or comments as we move along today. What's your favorite movie of all time? Or maybe what's your favorite summer movie? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking summer films today with Jameson Rabbit. It's great to have him with us today. And I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts, questions, or comments. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. He's host of the program Real Reviews. Great to have him with us. We had someone asked about Bill Murray's The Friend.
Oh, yeah. There was a movie that came out a few months ago. I believe it's streaming now, if I remember right. I haven't seen it yet because it kind of came and went out of theaters real quickly.
Okay. So it wasn't, in other words, it was not successful.
It was not a big hit. No.
And one I, before we take a call here, one that I wanted to mention was, what's the dragon?
How to Train Your Dragon.
How to Train Your Dragon.
Sure.
Now, that one, I've seen the trailers to that. They look pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, so this is a live-action remake of an animated franchise that DreamWorks made. They made three movies that were all great. I loved them all. This is live action with obviously animated dragons. And I really enjoyed it. It's fun. It's a remake. It's been out for just over a week. It made $160 million in just over a week, which is pretty great. And part of that is summer movies. The kids are out of school. Usually the big successes are the movies that you can bring the entire family to. That's what made, back in 1982, made E.T. like one of the biggest movies ever, was the entire family's going to the movies. So you're getting ticket money from everyone, and we go see it again. And usually kids, when they love a movie, they want to go see it again too. But How to Train Your Dragon, Elio is another animated movie that just came out this week. Pixar's newest movie that just came out this 3 days ago as we're talking. Another one that's just filling the seats with whole families.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me. And in the summertime, why not?
Yeah.
Take the kids.
Right. Get them something to do, right?
Well, it's kind of one of those things Lilo, is it Lilo and
Lilo
Stitch?
And Stitch, yeah. Yeah.
And what's that about?
So that was a Disney's remake of a live action movie that came out, I believe it was in the 90s. And it's a mostly live action with an animated Stitch. It's about this alien thing. This alien looks like kind of like a koala bear that lands on Earth, and Lilo, this little Hawaiian girl, takes him in, and he causes all kinds of trouble. And I took my daughter to it. She absolutely loved it. It was a lot of fun for her. It's got a decent little story to it. And it's, as we sit here, it's the number two movie on the year. It's made nearly $400 million already. It's been out for like 3 weeks. It's crazy.
Well, so that's definitely not going to stop Disney from...
No, this is their new thing, is remaking their animated classics. They mostly to what I think is disastrous results, but this one was pretty decent.
Yeah. Luke in central Wisconsin will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Luke.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Long-time listener. I just had to mention Forrest Gump. It's probably my number one all-time favorite movie. I just had to get you guys' opinion on that. Thanks.
All right.
Ooh, one of the biggest movies. Absolutely. Robert Zemeckis, Tom Hanks, big summer movie from, I believe it was 1996. Something like that. Yeah, in 98. Great movie, right? It's funny. That movie won Best Picture, was great, won Best Actor. And then it feels like recently the internet has made an attempt to say, well, that was a terrible movie. It's kind of become an internet joke of Forrest Gump, one of the worst Best Picture movies. I don't see that.
No, I at the time, I remember one of the things that was so cool about it was it was 1994.
Was it that long? Boy, yeah, okay.
Was the getting Forrest Gump in with a picture of President
sure.
Kennedy and making it look
pretty flawless.
So he was really there.
Yeah,
pretty flawless.
Yeah, putting him in all those situations. Yeah, it was a good time. Great soundtrack too. Incredible soundtrack.
Yeah, I enjoyed that very much. John wants to know, what's an underrated movie that you would recommend?
Right now? Underrated.
Or even thinking back.
Yeah. I mean, I would say still in theaters right now, a movie that I really enjoy, one of my favorite movies of this year, is a film called Sinners, starring Michael B. Jordan in the where he plays twin brothers. It's a vampire movie, unlike any other vampire movie I've seen. It's one of the best movies I've seen this year. It's really good. It's really interesting. Brings up a lot of dynamics that you wouldn't get in a normal vampire movie. That's a really good one. It's still in theaters right now. I'm trying to get people to go see it as much as possible before it leaves, because it's really an interesting movie.
It's
two twin brothers. It's set just after Prohibition. They come back from war. And they decide they're going to go back home to the bayou and open up a juke joint and live their dream and have a juke joint and something for their people in their little town. And of course, it doesn't go as quite as smooth as you want, but it's also vampires show up, but it's really a love story to blues music. There's a lot of great blues music. They want to open this up celebrate the music of their culture. And some guys who have never died show up and start wrecking havoc on the place. And it's way better than just a vampire movie. I don't want to get too much into it because there's a lot going on in there, but it's great. And Michael B. Jordan playing twin brothers really flawlessly, much like Forrest Gump, where he got inserted into things. These two guys are on the screen at the same time, played by one actor, and it looks flawless. I forget that he was one actor at points.
Titanic. Somebody brought up here.
Sure.
Titanic. And that was that a summer?
I don't remember. So here's the thing. I went 20 years without seeing Titanic. That movie came out and I rebelled against it. I was dating my now wife at the time. And she went and saw it several times with her friends and roommates. And I said, I'm not going to see that movie. I know how it ends. I'm not going to some sappy movie. And it took me 23 years to finally go see that movie. So,
did you see it in the theater?
I did not see it in the theater. I watched it like 5 years ago. I finally said, okay, I'm going to watch it. For a big, on our show, I made it a big moment. Like, okay, if we get to this milestone, I will watch Titanic for the show. And I did. And good movie. Good movie. I was just being obstinate about it for the longest time.
Well, the thing about that movie was that people, especially young women, I guess I'm remembering mm-hmm. this right, saw it like six, seven.
Yeah,
eight.
My wife went and saw it. I think five or six times. She would bring her roommates and various friends of hers, and just over and over going to see it. It was the largest movie ever at the time until James Cameron broke it with Avatar. I mean, he just keeps setting the bar higher and higher with subsequent movies.
Yeah, I loved Avatar.
Yeah. Well, there'll be another four or five of those coming out eventually.
I didn't like the remakes. The first one was the best.
Sure, yeah. Sure.
Yep. Rob in Marshfield, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Rob.
Hey, thanks for the show. It's been fun to listen to. I just wanted to give kind of a shout-out to one of my favorite books about movies, and it has so many great suggestions. It's called The Best Old Movies for Families by Ty Burr.
Mm.
And it is, the guy is a great movie critic. And each movie, it kind of gives an age recommendation. It kind of tells what you need to know before you watch the movie, if you have to explain it to the kids a little bit. Things you might have to pause button explanations. And then if you love this one, here's all the movies you want to watch next. And it goes from toddler up through teens. It starts from the silent movies up into maybe the early 60s, and it is just a phenomenal read and great movie suggestions.
And what's the guy's name again?
Ty Burr, B-U-R-R, and it's The Best Old Movies for Families.
Wow, I love that. Thanks for the recommendation on that.
I jotted that down. Rob, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Someone else is wondering, how do people see your show or hear your show?
Sure. I mean, locally here in Madison, where I'm at, I'm on the local KSUN channel. Listen to it on 103.5 FM here. But I also put it up on YouTube. It's Real Reviews TV. If you search Real Reviews TV on YouTube, you'll find it. And I'm also on Facebook and Instagram under the same title, Real Reviews TV, and post links to the show every week. We've been going now for 11 years.
So it's been has to have been successful.
Yeah, it's great. We went 10 years where I did every single week for 10 years, never missed a week. It was 500 and some episodes in a row. And then I took a little break, and now we are a monthly program because the schedule got to be too much. But I would watch, I still watch 500-600 movies a year. But it got to be a little hectic every single week.
I don't know how you,
because you have to watch all the movies, make notes for all the movies, and then do the show and talk about the movies, which was the best part, but yeah, it to be a little much.
Well, you know, I was thinking about how many books that I do in the course of a year for the show, and it's a little, it's 50-some books.
Sure.
So it's one about a book a week.
Yeah.
And you read the book, you take notes.
Yeah.
It takes a bit of work. So.
It does. Yeah. Just the prep. Yeah. Impressive.
I tell you what, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. This has been great.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. I'm going to be, probably the next, I'll see that final Mission Impossible.
There
next.
You go.
Thanks a lot for being with us today. A lot of fun. Jameson Rabbit, hosts a movie review program, Real Reviews, and it's also available on YouTube channel and a whole lot of other places, as he's mentioned. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll stay with us. We got lots of good things coming up, and we've got a great staff. Joel Patna and Clara Neipert, our producers, Jill Nadeau, our executive producer, Lee Jeff Robbins, our producer, our technical director, as well as is Lee Rayburn. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store.